Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to another Motorsport Magazine podcast, and you join us in London in a week when the United Kingdom is freezing up, in a week when Sebastian Vettel must be happy that the Australian Grand Prix is not the next on the calendar. Clearly a man who's consumed so much Red Bull that he now thinks he's not only the driver, but the team manager as well. And in a week when two women present Formula One on the BBC, and Jake Humphrey, previously of Formula One on the BBC, is now on another channel talking to women about having babies. The world is always changing. And with us on the podcast today is one of those women from the BBC, Lee McKenzie, also a contributor now to the Motorsport Magazine website and a hugely popular one too. Before we get going, I must tell you about the latest subscription offer for Motorsport Magazine. And this one is a very special offer for you, the listeners to our podcast. If you subscribe to Motorsport today, you can save up to £29 and receive a free Motorsport book. And this is a good one. It's the collection of Simon Taylor's Lunch With articles from our magazine. And as we all know, Simon's Lunch With is one of the most popular features of them all. So, if you subscribe today, save £29 and get Simon Taylor's Lunch With book worth £20. Well, £19.99, give or take. Anyway, if you want to take us up on this offer, then come to our website, which is motorsportmagazine.com, and that's /ST13. motorsportmagazine.com/ST13, or you can call us on 0207 349 8472, and surprise, surprise, quote podcast. With us around the table today is our editor-in-chief, Nigel Roebuck, Simon Aaron, fresh from Sepang, our editor, Damien Smith, and of course, Lee McKenzie, who is also fresh as a daisy from sweaty old Sepang. So welcome, everybody. I guess we've got to get one thing out of the way, haven't we, really? Should he be punished or not, Lee McKenzie?
I saw John Watson's comments about this. I think it's very difficult to punish and penalise a driver for winning a Grand Prix. If, when passing Mark Webber, he'd taken both of them out, that's a very different story. But to penalise a driver for winning a race, I don't think you can do that.
Agreed.
Dead right. There's no regulation, is there, about that? So he hasn't done anything wrong in the eyes of the law. So I think internally, Christian Horner's got now a very difficult situation to handle there, and that's probably the most challenging team manager situation he's ever faced. I would say even more than Turkey 2010. This is bigger. I mean, this is Vettel's Raskas moment, isn't it, essentially? And he's got...
Or Adelaide. Or
but, yeah, Silverstone.
I wouldn't want to be in Christian's shoes right now.
No, I mean, I can't really add anything to that. It's there's a side of you that kind of admires the ruthless pragmatist. I mean, it's the kind of ruthlessness that you've seen from Senna, you've seen from Michael Schumacher. possibly not from Ralf Schumacher. But, you know, that's the kind of separator. It's a bit, in some ways, a couple of years ago when we saw Fernando Alonso dive inside Felipe Massa inside the pit lane in Valencia. It's the same kind of ruthless mindset. I'm not saying the circumstances are entirely the same, but, you know, it's just, that's the kind of separator that the guys who win multiple world championships, you know, have.
Yep.
Yeah, I can't argue with any of that, except all I would say is, whatever the hell multi-21 means, and obviously it means whole station.
I'm going to use it a lot.
And, you know, whole station means whole station.
I think as
Weber
well.
Weber had led most of the way, and if it would have been one thing if Weber had plainly been beaten out of the pits. But he wasn't.
No,
I just think if you're going to operate like this, I mean, for sure, not that he's ever trusted him, but there's no way in the world Mark Webber is ever going to trust Vettel for 1 second again. And I thought the most telling comment, actually, the whole weekend was Christian saying, well, there was no point in telling him to give the place back because he wouldn't have taken notice. So then you are bound to conclude, Christ, people talk about Alonso running Ferrari. This is a different level altogether at Red Bull.
Yeah, and the reason Mark Webber was ahead was because he timed his first tyre stop correctly. I mean, Vettel went too soon. Mark would have been a perfectly deserving winner of that race.
And can you imagine what it would look like to all the viewers around the world if a driver was penalised for winning a Grand Prix? You can't penalise a footballer for scoring a goal. And if they're your sort of casual viewers and even those who understand, it just would be inherently wrong, I think, to actually get to that stage. What they do internally is a whole different matter.
Actually, talking about things that are set up, if you like, with 20 or 15 laps to go, Lee. As a punter, it seems to me that a couple of other things are going on, because they're not driving the cars flat out, because they can't, because of the tyres. Two teams spent the last 15 laps of the last race holding station, or not, as the case may be. I mean, are we looking at real, real racing here?
Well, no, I don't think we are. And even Mark Webber said afterwards, there is a naivety when people watch sport, and it doesn't matter what sport it actually is. I've never interviewed a more miserable top four in my life. You suddenly thought, have I got this wrong or something? You know, there's people ecstatic to be 13th, and I'm like interviewing guys that look like, you know, they've run over their own dog or something.
You look at the podium, it was like as somebody died.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And, you know, I think, and that's a shame. That is a shame. And I don't think we need to be too naive about it. But if you can't race, and if you can't, as I said in my column in Motorsport, if you can't enjoy winning a Grand Prix, then you have to wonder what the point is.
But also, you wouldn't have Man United and Real Madrid saying, with 20 minutes to go, okay, it's 1-1, let's leave it at that. You know, I mean,
well, it happened between Austria and Germany in the World Cup once, I seem to recall. But the, I think it's slightly odd the way things have flipped around. I mean, you go back to Le Mans, before cars had electronic guardian angels and can be driven flat out around the clock. And the guys that won the race were those who were very good at driving consistently at a percentage. You know, guys like Henri Pescarello, Derek Bell, who were Olivier Jean de Bien, were multiple winners there. They weren't absolute top liners in F1, but at Le Mans, where the game was slightly different, and there were some very, very fast Le Mans winners, you know, Rindt, X, etc., Dan Gurney. But now, sports cars are driven flat out around the clock because they can be, and F1 cars are being driven at 80-85%, so we're not actually seeing a true picture. Personally, I mean, if with, you know, durable tyres the Red Bulls rushed off and won by a fortnight, well, so be it. That's because they've done a better job, and I'd rather see a true picture than something that's manipulated by engineering a car for tyre life.
I entirely agree with Simon. I thought last year, where everybody was getting terribly excited, the first seven races or whatever, they were all won by different drivers. And I just thought, no, this can't be right. You know, this is not reality.
Mm.
And I thought, I must say, in Sepang, I thought it had reached this whole tyre thing. I thought it had reached a whole, you know, a new level. And to me, it was farcical that we were treated the last 20 minutes through, you know, angry drivers on the radio, you know, moaning. It just seemed to, I just thought this has lost reality. This is not Grand Prix racing.
But Lee, you're talking to a global TV audience, and it's all about entertainment, and they're loving it, aren't they?
Yeah, they are loving it. But I think when you think back to, was it Canada 2010, 2011, when we had that extraordinary race when, before Pirelli came in, and I think everyone thought, wow, what an exciting race, tyres going off, and here we go. And then it almost became the norm. So that novelty factor is gone now. Mm. And it just, some, I think there's a lot of people thinking, why can't we just get back to the racing? You know, a race like that is exciting every once in a while. But, you know, even if you look back at last season, we were going to Valencia thinking, oh goodness, it's Valencia. And then it was an exciting race, and you're thinking, well, how did that happen? And you were having to watch things back a couple of times to think, did that happen? Now, that's great, because we want to have exciting Formula One racing. But I think it also has to be true, and maybe obviously not the word honest racing, but, you know, proper Grand Prix racing, so people can look back and not think it's a joke era, that it's a proper true era of having, you know, five or six, like last year, great world champions on the grid.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, I mean, Lee is perfectly right. All through the history of the sport, there have always been races that have been won and lost on tyres.
Yeah, sure.
But that was, you know, happenstance. Now it's actually engineered into the formula. And, you know, I speak to fans, and some of them are fundamentally baffled by the very idea of building deliberately terrible tyres.
Well, I can relate to that.
Anyway, I was saying to Maurice Hamilton the other day, you know, I very often, in a circumstance like this, think, God, what would Jenks have made of all this? And Jenks was always, I have to say, bored stiff by tyres. He was, oh, don't understand tyres, not interested. But the very idea of building something to stop a racing car going as quickly as it could would be anathema to him.
Damien mentioned global television entertainment, and the women are taking over, aren't they? So we've got to ask you the big one, haven't we? How disappointing was it
not to get the job, or to be working with Eddie again? Not to get the job. It was disappointing. Yeah, I've got to say it was disappointing, and I did have to sit back and decide whether I wanted to continue. Not because I was throwing my toys out the pram, or I didn't want to be a number two driver. Just because, you know, I wasn't quite understanding why I didn't get the job. Now, as it happens, there's been a couple of moments where I've sort of sat back and thought, actually, I do love the job I do. I absolutely love speaking to the drivers. And Brazil last year, I was the only one out of the BBC team or whoever that managed to get to speak to Sebastian, Fernando Alonso, Lewis Hamilton, these guys. And it was the same on Sunday. And, you know, when you do interviews that are well received, and the Webber and Vettel interviews that I did seem to be very well received, you know, that's actually a really nice thing, because I think probably that's what I'm good at, that's what I'm better at, but, you know, it would still have been nice to get the opportunity. You know, no one ever likes to be overlooked. I think probably that's what it comes down to when there's a lot of egos involved and things. I still present the Inside F1 on the Friday night and Saturday night on the news channel. I'll still stand in as a main presenter when Susie can't do it, but I mean, I'm not in a bad situation, am I? I still get to go to every Grand Prix, and I absolutely love my job.
I got to tell you, I'm pretty worried about you sitting here next month.
You should be, Rob. You should be.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a hell of a buzz getting a good interview, isn't it, though?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know when you're getting a good interview. There have been a lot of times where you know you're not getting a good interview.
Paul de Resta.
Kimi Raikkonen. Dare I mention those words? That, I mean, I got a lot of abuse for the one that went out on Saturday.
Because
we put him in a very bad light, but I'm not quite sure if he needed our help.
There's nothing to do with him. Exactly.
But you know, I knew when Lewis was doing his best Ali G in Monaco a couple of years ago. I knew when Rubens was saying about blah blah blah, that's what the team will tell me, and I knew on Sunday, and as I say, you do an awful lot of interviews where people are talking about tyres and pit stops and things, and don't get me wrong, that's important, But when you can get the real human element out, the sort of disappointment, the guilt, the emotions, you know, that's what I Absolutely. I enjoy. Absolutely. Trying to make people cry, that's what brings me happiness.
I think Jay Humphrey's doing that on Channel 4 with women having babies, isn't he? Is that?
And he's his wife had a baby in the last few days as well, right. So there'll be a lot of noise in his house.
But I guess you get quite a rapport with the drivers, given how much you see them and...
Yeah, you do. I mean, we see them. I sometimes think they're probably sick of the sight of me. I'll interview them from the Thursday right through till the Sunday. And we do sit-down interviews. A lot of these guys I've known since GP2 or even F3000 and things like that. And I do still make it my business to know. I'll still go over to the GP2 paddock. You know, I went to a couple of rounds of British F3 last year and stuff. So I do make it my business to know the drivers coming through. And then it's not a shock. Then it's just they look up and think, oh God, is she still here with her microphone? But I think that's important. And I think probably that's why the drivers do speak to me in a slightly different way. And it's very different on television as well, because, you know, sometimes I'll go to the Fleet Street interviews and you see them. And if they ask a question to Lewis, for example, and Lewis doesn't like it, he'll say to them, "You're an idiot. Why would you ask me that?" That never gets heard of again. No one would write that in the thing. If someone calls me an idiot, it's on camera and everyone can see that. So there's a very different thing. It's a very public way of interviewing my way, whereas I think quite a lot of the written press can hide the abuse. But if a driver gives me abuse, then it's there for everyone to see.
No, absolutely. You're very exposed.
Yeah, you
absolutely.
Are.
You'll be very pleased to know, Lee, that we've got a whole page of questions for you, which shows you just how popular your motorsport magazine work is. can we get one thing other thing out of the way? And what is it with you and Eddie Jordan?
I don't know. I tried to think what the context is.
Well, I mean, you know,
that's
I think
a leading question.
No. But I think if we're lucky enough to have a television presenter with us, we have to ask what the real deal is here. I mean, do you and Eddie get on well?
Yeah, we do get on well. He's actually been. He's quite protective in a worrying way of me. He does always make sure that I'm fine, that I'm, you know, getting looked after at the BBC and all the rest of it. I mean, he can be an absolute nightmare. And when I'm trying to sit in the office and write my script and he's buzzing around and trying to show me photos of his, you know, round the world boat trip and stuff like that, that's not the time. So there is quite a lot of heated argument. And he does say I speak to him like nobody else has ever spoken to him. But then there's this other, it's like a loyalty. I was in an airport lounge and I picked up, I don't know what magazine it was, and Eddie jumps out of you when you least expect it. When you go to buy a suitcase, he's the face of a suitcase manufacturer, and when you go to have a cocktail, he's the face of a gin company, and you think, oh, like, there's no escape. So I was sitting in an airport lounge and I picked up a magazine, and it was like, you know, the history of Eddie Jordan in Formula One, and it was of all the amazing people that you've ever worked with in Formula One, and you've brought in lots of drivers, who would you class as your best friends in Formula One? And bizarrely, he named Peter Sauber and me, which is very kind. But I do think, you know, I'm not saying it damaged my street cred, but if people think that I, every night of my life, I'm going out for dinner with Peter Sauber and Eddie Jordan, you know, it did make me think, oh my goodness. But that was very sweet of him to do that. But yeah, he is very protective of me. Sometimes you need it, and other times. A lot of times you don't need it.
I think that sums it up very, very, very neatly, actually, doesn't it? Okay, back to the more serious business. You were a co-driver in the World Rally Championship. I mean,
I was asked when I was doing a program called Speed Sunday. I was asked to sit alongside. Tony Jarden, as many people have done, and off we went into the distance. I ended up doing three rounds of the British Championship and then Rally GB, and that went actually better than I think most people expected, including me. And then off we went again to Norway, to Rally Norway, and that was scary. That was very scary. I think maybe about five of the stages had been cancelled. But I absolutely loved it. I really did. I've always wanted to do the Arctic Rally, and I would hate to think that maybe that was my final foray into rallying, but I did really enjoy it. But also I do know my limits, you know, and I knew that I was there because I was on television and I could get coverage for him and all the rest of it. I wasn't thinking I was the next big star in co-driving.
He's good at that. He's got me in for a couple. I've done two national ones in Fiestas with him, and we've yet to finish a rally actually. So first one the gearbox broke, and his language was quite choice. The second one, I got lost in the notes, so I shut up, and he was going, it's okay, and then we crashed. And they had a camera attached to the front of the car looking back at us, and I just looked like a naughty schoolboy who'd, you know, been caught. And his language was, you know, it's not the Tony Jardine you used to see on telly, that's for sure.
Well, we actually crashed, and it was a place where obviously no one should crash because there were no fans for miles. And as we flew over and landed on top of a pile of logs, so the car's just balancing cartoon style, you just see him going, "Get out and push, darling," whilst he still sat there. And I ended up having to run for about over a mile, and I found these three very elderly Welsh fans in the middle of the forest. And Tony always says, as we were running along, one of the old men like fell flat on his face, and I said to him, "Are you okay?" And he went, "Yes, I am." I said, "Well, get up then." And Tony said it was the most embarrassing thing he's seen, and he would rather have just left the car, like, you know, balancing precariously. But no, I did enjoy it. It was great fun.
It's a tough old world, isn't it, eh? Absolutely. Can we look ahead briefly to the next Grand Prix, which is, as we speak, is what, 2.5 weeks? Yeah. Good thing it's not Melbourne, as far as Vettel's concerned, I would say. But anyway, China, I always think, quite a boring race, a bit of a boring track. But do you think that we'll see much change before we come to Europe, or do you think that the pattern we've kind of got at the moment is what we're going to get until Europe?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? I'm not really sure if we've got a pattern as yet. I mean, I think that Mercedes are hoping that they're going to go to China and be as good again as they were last year. Obviously, that double DRS had a huge impact last year as well. But I think there's so... The dynamics at the moment, the politics at the moment, will have to calm down a lot, because we don't really know the implications of that. I mean, people yesterday were even saying, you know, would Mark Webber turn up to China? Now, I didn't ever get the feeling that he wouldn't. But, you know, it depends really what happens in these teams to settle things down, because there's going to be a lot of tension there within Red Bull. We don't even know, maybe within Mercedes. What McLaren can do over the next couple of weeks is absolutely crucial as well. You know, they need a whole new front of the car. Gary Anderson was saying that a lead time for a front wing and things would be, what, 2 weeks? So if they actually can try and make some magic in the next couple of weeks, then they might play a slightly bigger part. And the weather in China's, you know, can be iffy as well. So I'm not really sure. I don't think it's going to be like the start of last year, but I'm not sure if it will necessarily be a Red Bull or a Lotus that will win China.
I think... one thing to say about China is that it is actually finally beginning to mature as an event. I remember a few years ago walking around the track on Friday morning with Mark Hughes, and he counted the number of spectators. I think there were 57 or 58. I mean, there were lots and lots of soldiers and officials and stuff, but 58 punters actually sitting in grandstands. Last year, for the first time on race day, you actually sensed there was a kind of proper, I mean, there's a railway line that now runs from Shanghai to the circuit, and you actually sense last year there was a proper audience, a cosmopolitan audience, and people start, I mean, there are still grandstands there that have never had a bum on them ever. They've got advertising tarpaulins over them. But just last year, it felt as though there was a bit of a crowd starting, and it began to feel more like an event should. I mean, the circuit is still too far from Shanghai, which is a wonderful city, but the circuit's, you know, nowhere near it, but it does feel like it's beginning to mature as an event, and I think, you know, it is a good thing.
Nigel, I mean, are McLaren going to come back? They are, aren't they? They've got to, haven't they?
Well, they always do, don't they? The thing that gets more difficult to get used to with McLaren is these sort of poor starts to seasons are actually you know, becoming much more frequent than they ever were. I mean, you know, we all remember the year with the chaotic start of the year when Mansell couldn't actually fit in the car. You remember that?
I do remember.
That terrible twin rear wing thing, whichever number it was. But that was very much the exception at the time. McLaren normally, you know, started the season well. And, you know, look, 12 months ago, Melbourne last year. I mean, Lewis and Jensen had the front row to themselves.
Long time since they've won a championship.
So, yeah. But they've taken a risk, haven't they? I mean, this is the last year of the V8 formula. And they finished the year last year with the best car. And the temptation ordinarily would have thought would be simply to evolve it for one last year, instead of which they've gone radical, if you like, as Ferrari did 12 months ago.
Do you think Martin Whitmarsh should be worried? I mean, if this was a football team, we'd say his position would be under threat. I mean, he's extremely honest. We know after Melbourne, he was very frank about the situation they were in. And again, in Malaysia, they'd improved slightly, but they're still a long way away. But the fact is, he's the guy in charge. He's not the team owner. He's got people to answer to. Is there a concern there for him?
I don't think there should be. But, you know, who knows? I've always had the impression, with perhaps one single notable exception, he has the support of the of the board.
Who could that be?
Certainly, you know, Mansur, OJ, for instance, you know, is a huge supporter and fan of Martin's. So I wouldn't have thought his position was in doubt. I don't think he should be.
Jensen made the point in Malaysia that although they were still far from being, you know, pitch perfect, he said that he had the sense that they even in the 4 or 5 days, they had made a significant, whether they'd been more than a second off the pace in Australia, he felt in reality in Malaysia it was like half a second, still nowhere near good enough, but a quantum step in the right direction.
Well, I suppose it helps the situation, you know, the situation with Paddy Lowe, you know. He ain't there to help things along, and you know that, which can't be a great thing for the team.
What's your take on what's happening at McLaren?
It's been interesting to see. I mean, Jensen has looked so disheartened and downbeat, and he was a bit better on Sunday, it's got to be said. He was a bit more maybe philosophical or accepting of the situation, I suppose. You know, I think it's the first weekend, it must be a bit of a shock when that realisation kicks in, especially when he's gone to Melbourne and been so strong in the past couple of years. And to finish off, as you said, Nigel, with, you know, a car which has won the last two Grand Prix last season, you know, it's not good to get into this situation. But they need to catch. It used to be that you could almost rely on Ferrari sort of turning up in Barcelona to start their Formula One campaign in the last few years. And sadly, it looks like this year it's McLaren's turn. It all depends on how quickly they can catch up. And if it, is it one problem which is fixable, or does one problem lead to another problem? And I'm not sure if they even know that at this stage. But it was interesting when you said, I think, you said about it's been a long time since McLaren won a championship. Yeah. It was interesting hearing Martin talking about team orders and saying that he was happy. The year that Fernando and Lewis, you know, both could have won the championship, they didn't give any team orders, and that actually cost them the championship.
Sure did.
But that is actually, you know, not a problem as far as he's concerned, because he's got a clear conscience about that. So it's quite a different take on the team order situation, that maybe they threw away a chance, maybe that was silly, everyone's got their own opinion of it. But it was just, you know, when we're in this world of cynical team orders, whether it be Mercedes or Red Bull, that McLaren maybe gave away that opportunity to win another championship.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
But that's always been the philosophy at McLaren.
Sure.
And that may be, you know, the one and only thing left that Ron and Martin actually agree about.
I would think so, definitely.
But that has never changed all the way through. Ron was always
a racer,
allowing his drivers to race, and Martin's the same.
Yeah. Can we move on to some questions for Lee McKenzie, of which we have a great many? And I want to start with the one I like best, which comes from a Finn. Yes, his name is Arne Guala.
I can say Rakastan Suomer, which means I love Finland, so that will hopefully appease whatever else I'm about to say.
Do you know what? She's answered it.
What's
answered
that?
You have answered the question. Well, it wasn't... You love Finland.
Doesn't what he speak any Finnish?
Thank you, Nigel. The question actually is, do you love or hate Finnish drivers? Come on, Lee.
I'm not sure if I have to love or hate them.
No, you don't.
Well, I think... I'm not really sure. I mean, Valtteri Bottas was my neighbour for quite a while, and I find him just a fascinating character.
He is.
I think his dedication to the sport is excellent, but it's also quite amusing. You know, even before Japan last year, when he was driving on free practice, he started like setting his alarm clock to get onto Japanese time something like 8 to 10 days before he went. So he was like running around in the Oxfordshire countryside in the pitch black.
But he's fit as well.
He is absolutely super fit. Apart from the fact the first time I met him was in the Summertown Wine Cafe, but never mind, we'll scan over that. But yeah, it's yeah, I always like Finnish drivers. I like their attitude. I like, there's so many Finns in the paddock now as well. I think there's 6 or 7 trainers who are Finnish as well. You know, Lewis's trainer's Finnish, Sebastian's trainer's Finnish. No, I like my Finnish friends.
Okay, good answer. I hope that answers you, Arne. If it
off
doesn't,
the hook, I think. Yeah.
Too bad. Tom Arnold wants to know who is the hardest driver to interview.
I think Kimi. Kimi is
pretty
hardest.
Obviously, really.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. Even when he won, it still wasn't a particularly easy interview because he will. He doesn't necessarily challenge you, but he doesn't give you the answer you expect, and that's not a bad thing. You know, I'm not expecting people to agree with me, and
no, sure.
when you talk to them. But he is probably the most difficult one.
It's
hard work. It is hard work to speak to him.
We've talked about McLaren, but it would be great, says Patrick Kelly, if I could ask one of the following, so I will. What's your favourite place to go to a Grand Prix?
Well, different reasons. I love Spa. I love Spa as a circuit. I think it's fantastic. I don't mind the rain. I like the atmosphere there. I think it's
wonderful.
Fantastic. I like to have a walk around. And the fact that you can do Spa and Monza normally in 7 days or this year in 2 weeks, that's really what motor racing is all about. Bizarrely then, we head off to Singapore, which is also another fantastic place. And it's polar opposite. But to me, that works well. You know, I'm not one of these people that doesn't like going to Monaco. A lot of people in F1 say, oh, it's such hard work and it's not easy to get around and all the rest of it, but you can never feel but excited and sort of privileged to be there when you see people are paying so much money to be there. You know, you should enjoy it. If you don't enjoy it, then you know,
it's pretty dramatic place to
exactly.
watch a racing car.
It's not maybe the most exciting Grand Prix, but for me, Spa is a great circuit. I love going there.
I'd just like to say about Monaco as well that the thing that, I mean, it's the slowest average lap of the season, but from trackside, it looks like the fastest by a factor of a million, because just, you know, proximity embellishes the spectacle, and it's wonderful to see that.
And also, in actual fact, you will never get closer to a Grand Prix. You'll never get closer to a paddock without having a paddock pass. And you do. I think it's a great place for fans to come, because even, you know, to get from the.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Paddock to Red Bull, you've got to have Mark Webber and Sebastian Vettel walking around in public areas and things. That doesn't happen anywhere else.
I feel it my duty to say that you can get very close to a Grand Prix car at the Goodwood Festival of Speed.
That's true. They're not going quite as quickly as they are in Monaco
though. No, they're not.
But the privilege I always found working in Monaco was getting a Tabard and going in the tunnel.
I was just going to say the same. Yeah. I mean, however jaded you think you might be,
yeah.
2 minutes in there.
Yeah.
You can't hear for the rest of the weekend, but that's, it's worth losing your hearing.
It is spine chilling.
There was a Coke machine which sold other fizzy products as well. But I used to have to hide behind it. Do you remember this?
Oh, yes.
And you'd poke your head out just in case anything went wrong. And the Coke machine was your protection, basically, if anything happened. But it was just incredible. Just such a sight and sound. It's, that's the bonus of being where we are, isn't it?
Let's move to a question that's of more general interest to a global audience, because we have one of those too, by the way. Massa at Ferrari out-qualified Alonso both races, both
Grand Prix.
Last four Grand Prix, thank you. Yeah, thank God Simon's here. His factual memory is amazing. What's going on there, Nigel?
Well, I mean, for a start, Massa is, you know, starting to look now like the driver he was before his accident. The bigger mystery to me is what on earth was so wrong 12 months ago? Because he wasn't sort of just slightly behind his teammate at that stage. He was, I mean, they were at different ends of the grid.
Well, they were talking about getting rid of him.
And of course they were, but I'm sure Mark Webber was offered the driver at that point, and I'm sure he now is thinking to himself, mate, what was I thinking of? But anyway, he did get it back in the second half of last year. And I'm really interested and curious to know, and I haven't heard any sort of satisfactory answer from anywhere, well, what did it? I think there's a case to be made for saying, like McLaren always said, when the car was perfect, nobody could beat Prost. When the car wasn't perfect, nobody could beat Senna. And I think last year, when the car was pretty bloody awful most of the year, let's face it, Alonso was able to get a lot more out of it than Massa was. Now the car is pretty good to drive, and Felipe's got his confidence back, and I don't think it's necessarily a surprise. You know, you think of them, I mean, I know Kimi won his championship in his first year at Ferrari, but fundamentally, if you analyse those three seasons, there's no question, you know, prior to the accident in Hungary, no question which Ferrari driver was their leading light, and it was Felipe.
Yeah, memories are short, aren't they?
Of course. You know, and you know, we all know how good Kimi is. It'll surprise me if this routinely out-qualifying Fernando goes on, but the fact is, for the first time in a long time, Ferrari have actually got two drivers, you know, doing justice to the car.
When Massa came back at his first race after the accident, Bahrain 2010, I mean, he out-qualified Ferdi there as well, and by, I can't remember, 3/10, I mean, it was quite a sizable margin, but then Fernando had nailed him by turn two, and that was kind of the pattern set until sort of 10 into last year, really.
And I must say, a lot of people have gone on about Hockenheim that year, you know, when Massa was told to move over, which I thought the reaction to that was absolutely ludicrous, frankly, because it was patently obvious Ferrari only had one hope for the world championship, and that was Alonso. Of course, there was supposedly a ban on team orders at that time, which is why there was such a furore about it. Ever since then, there have been people have suggested, oh, well, you know, poor Felipe never got over that. Well, give me a break.
I mean,
he's a big boy.
Is this?
You don't sulk for 2 years, so I can't believe it was that.
Is this a talking point in the paddock, Lee? Or is it just
Felipe's upturn of form?
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually have been talking about it quite a lot, but I interviewed him, I can't remember where it was last year. Towards the end of last year anyway, and he basically said he'd had no confidence, he doesn't know what went wrong, he just couldn't get it, he couldn't get to grips with things. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, as Nigel was saying, something has clicked and it's all come good. But last year I'd interview Fernando, and you could almost not have watched qualifying and you knew that he would have been qualified in fifth. Yeah. That was just the situation. So you sort of went, Fernando, fifth again, and he'd laugh and you'd laugh and off you'd go. But he knows that it doesn't matter really where he qualifies, Sunday is his day. And he will always be in front, it looks like. And you know, people talk about betting in Formula One and team orders. I would never bet on Felipe Massa to win a Grand Prix. I'd bet on Fernando Alonso to win a Grand Prix, and that's with Felipe out qualifying for the last four Grand Prix. You just know that Sunday is going to be Fernando's day rather than Felipe's. Yeah, and that's a shame, but that's the way it is.
It's a good point.
But, I mean, Fernando is... You never really... You know, you see stunning laps from Ayrton Senna, Michael Schumacher over the years. I can't recall ever seeing an absolutely stellar Fernando Alonso lap. Not one that really sticks in my mind.
I think Monza...
But, I mean, the level he drives at every single lap. Look at a race history chart, and his lap times are just... I mean, it's
metronomic.
I mean, absolutely, but I mean, all metronomically fast as well.
Yeah. Oddly enough, when you're talking about a stunning single qualifying lap, if I were trying to think of one in connection with him, I would think of Monza and the Renault with the damaged car, which was simply out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I think, mind you, having said that, I thought his pole position at Silverstone in the wet last year was pretty something.
Yes, it was. But I mean, last year he had a couple of poles in the wet. I mean, always a great leveler. Hockenheim is the same. But it's just you don't sort of nothing. That really, I can't recall one that really took your breath away.
No, I agree.
Except
that one time in the Renault. That's the one that sticks in my mind, but I agree with you.
Okay, let's move on to another question for Lee, and it comes from Patrick Kelly, and you'll see why the name Patrick Kelly is relevant in just a second, because he wants to know, are there any really good young Irish drivers coming up from other Formulae? Because it's quite a long time, isn't it, since we had a really top Irish driver? I'm looking at Simon because he's bound to say no, of course. Don't you remember something?
Are we talking Northern and Southern?
Yeah.
As a collective?
Well, I worked with Adam Carroll for a lot of years and did his PR, and I'm very happy to see that he's now involved in GTs with McLaren this season. That's great. And there is a driver who won what I think it was 6 or 7 GP2 races against your Lewis's and Rosbergs and all that sort of thing. He won at Monaco, he won Spa, he won Silverstone, you know, the proper tracks for a driver to prove themselves. Where's the money that you need nowadays to get in? And as I say, I'm delighted that he's driving again this year. He actually also driver coaches Will Buller. He was going to William Buller, who was doing
GP3 last year
and won a race as well. And Adam was coming to races and driver coaching him. So I suppose you would look at him.
Adam's the name I'd have picked out of the hat as the one in recent years who's missed out. But
sure.
He still is a very, very talented driver. He's just unlucky that he didn't get the brakes.
Okay. We should say at this point that Motorsport magazine, the one that's coming out any minute now, the end of this week.
As we speak, the subscription copies should be landing on doormats.
Right.
Hopefully.
Good. I'd like the editor just to give us a quick rundown on a new look.
Yes. We've changed, but not too much. So basically the content is still pretty much as it was before, with a few minor additions. Haven't taken anything away. There's still a lot of words. I was asked last year how many words there are on an issue. I reckon it's something like 55,000, which is there's a lot of books shorter than that. So there's still a lot of words in the magazine. But basically we've got a bit of a refresh and a new look for the new year, basically. So the masthead is still green, which is the big thing that everyone would say to me if I ever mentioned change. But we're just, you know, publishing world these days, you can't just stand still and do the same thing over and over again. You've got to try and evolve and improve and find new areas to, you know, we're chasing sales, basically. Yes, so I'm not sure how the new look will go down. I'm always nervous with these things, but I'm sure we'll hear in the next few days, but hopefully they'll like what they see.
Keep a lookout for it anyway, everybody, because we need you more than you need us, probably. But anyway, we need you, and we love hearing from you, and thank you very much, everybody who's contributed today. Lee, can we talk briefly about Bernie Ecclestone, because a lot of people down the pub always ask me, you know, when's Bernie going to pack it in? What happens after Bernie? And I think this is an interesting question, because in 2014 we have brand new cars, brand new engines, a whole new look for Formula One, whether we think that's a good thing or not. And Bernie shows no sign of either slowing down or stopping. So what's your take on what might happen?
Well, interestingly, he wasn't actually at the first two Grand Prix of the year, which was quite unusual. I mean, who knows? He doesn't give any clues, and he loves to, you know, spark surprises. So I think you need someone who's much more sensible than me to come up with the true answer. There's some people saying it's going to be his lawyer who'll take things over. There's some people say that Toto Wolff is going to take things over. As a, you know, who knows? But it's certainly not me.
The way Toto Wolff will have taken over the entire planet. Damien, what can you speculate at all on?
It's really hard to speculate. I mean, it could be someone totally faceless from within CVC who end up being the guy pulling the strings.
No,
but I mean, you know, in a way, it'd be nice to see someone we know, you know, someone who. Well, I was going to say Christian Horner, but at the moment he's got enough to deal with. But, you know, if it was someone like Christian who could be the face of the sport and communicate to the world outside what's going on in a slightly more modern fashion than Bernie manages, that would be good. Well, we tried to pin Luca de Montezemolo down on this question. Andrew Frankel's done an interview for the magazine with Luca at the Geneva Motor Show, and I asked him specifically to ask him the Bernie question. And Luca sidestepped it, as he tends to. They've been friends for a long time, and he's not about to publicly, although he's put pressure on Bernie in the past, he's not going to say it's time to go. He did say that his friend Ratan Tata has stepped down from his business at the age of 75 because that's what the rules of his company were, and that it was time for him to go, and he stood by the rules of his company and has stepped down. So indicating that Bernie is at the age where he should be thinking about it. But it amazes me that we get to this stage and we don't know. We have got no idea. And it is all just speculation.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's been like that for 20 years. You know, everybody's always been, well, is there no succession plan? And you remember, I mean, Bernie had quad bypass surgery, didn't he? 10, 12 years ago. Which, you know, you might have thought might have sort of speeded up the process of considering the future, but it appears not to have done. I remember Ken Tyrrell once saying to Bernie, you know, Bernie, we've got to have a succession plan. We, you know, this is, and Bernie just said, "I'll live longer than you will, Ken."
Which was true, proved, sadly.
Well, this is the thing. He is almost always right about things, isn't he? That's the.
I mean, the paddock will be, I mean, obvious thing to say, but I mean, it will be an awful lot duller for his presence. Last year in China, I was working for a national newspaper that weekend, and all they wanted me to write about was Bahrain this, Bahrain that, Bahrain the other. We're all getting ready to go to Bahrain, blah, blah, blah. I said, we're in China, there's a race here. No, just want to write about Bahrain. Anyway, I bumped into Bernie by the lift shaft. At the bottom of the lift goes up to the press centre. I was standing a few, and he came in and said, "You guys okay?" "Yeah, fine, Bernie." "You going to Bahrain next weekend?" I said, "Yeah, we're going." I said, "Are you going?" He said, "Nah, far too dangerous." And off he wandered. I mean, of course he was going, but I just love the sort of the kind of random nature of Bernie. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I think as and when. You know, it is no longer Bernie. I think Formula One will change absolutely fundamentally. Mm-hmm. Because I can't see a single individual running it, really. I think it'll become much, much more faceless and anonymous. And something it's always rather appealed to me that, you know, Bernie may be king of the world and everything else, but he still, you know, you can go and thump on his door and
sure,
you know, and he'll talk.
Sure.
Yeah, and he doesn't, you know, even at the weekend when you saw the quotes that he put out about Lewis talking to Red Bull and rolling his eyes when he suggested he went to Mercedes, you know, the timing of him putting stuff out is just fantastic. And you sit there thinking, why would he have done that? And you think, well, why not? You know, he's sitting at home just throwing a few little grenades out and, in the comfort of his own home in London.
I would so much like him to retire and have a weekly television comedy show because he's one of the funniest men I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can we change the subject completely because we've only got about 10 minutes left? I wanted to just talk a bit about Robert Kubica because, I mean, his performance in the rally over the weekend, all right, okay, he didn't win it, but he's clearly really making progress. Do you think there's still room for him in Formula One or not, or do you think the time has passed?
It would be fantastic. I think he's a huge loss. I thought it was fantastic talent. A nice guy, you know, again, quite an edgy guy, always fun to interview. Whether we'll see him in Formula One, it's sounding increasingly
unlikely
because I think, you know, you can't come back unless you can actually do the job. And sadly, I think from the messages that he's putting out at the moment, he can't do the job.
Yeah.
It's great to see him in these rallies, but I was meant to go to a rally to interview him and things last year, and he'd been, you know, leading again by a country mile and then crashed out, and then obviously, you know, similar at the weekend, and it's just, you can sense there must be so much frustration.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at the moment, he's got all the talent, but he just needs to maybe rein it in a little. But, you know, the thing as well that I always say to young drivers as well, of course, everyone wants to be in Formula One. But actually, when they relax and realise that that might not be an option, there are plenty of other ways to enjoy motorsport and to earn a bit
absolutely.
Of money.
And
I think that, you know, Robert, whether he has or not, will probably want to get that into his head to understand that he doesn't actually have to be in Formula One to be able to enjoy motorsport. But you can tell how hard he's pushing at the moment.
Well, it was such a bad way to leave, wasn't it? That's the point, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely.
It's very telling that, I mean, bearing in mind that up until Robert, there was kind of no Polish involvement in Formula One at all. Nowadays, almost every circuit we go to, there are Polish flags in the grandstands with "We miss you, Robert. Get well soon, Robert."
Even at testing, pre-season testing.
Yeah, and it's almost every race, everywhere around the world, there are always Polish flags. And I have to say that, for me in 2010, he was the driver of the season. He was fantastic. Circuits where a driver can make a difference, Monaco, Suzuka, Spa, that car was either on the front, first or the second row. He dropped 3 points all year through a fault of his own, which was when he was fiddling with the steering wheel settings, about to change from wets to slicks or vice versa in the Belgian Grand Prix, and he overshot his pit box by 6 inches. And that was the only real error he made all season. He was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it struck me as significant that, I mean, all right, I know they were great, mate. Well, they are. As far as I know, still great mates. But for Alonso to say that he thought of Kubica as the most talented driver in the place.
Quite a statement.
Lewis has always said the same. That, on his way up, who's the most difficult guy
talent.
He came up against? Kubica.
The rallying really needs him as well, though, because, you know, the current era, it looks like Sebastian Ogier is going to be even more dominant than Loeb with the way things are going. And if Kubica can rein in the understandable errors when you first come into the sport, which I'm sure he will, because he's got the work ethic that Kimi doesn't have. He'll listen to his co-driver, he'll do the wreckying, and he could be wouldn't it be great if he became a world rally champion after everything he's been through?
And he doesn't have the name Sebastian, so
no, that's
quite refreshing in this world of motorsport that we're in at the moment.
It's a bit of the buzzword of the week, isn't it Sebastian?
Actually, just while we're on rallying, I thought it was when I was Anthony Davidson telling me about a conversation with Stefan Sarrazin about Kimi when Kimi was rallying, and he just, well, you know, the problem was Kimi, fundamentally, I mean, he had no interest in pace notes. It's a fairly fundamental omission. I mean, and it's not too difficult to believe either, is it, of Kimi? But no.
I do like Kimi Raikkonen. I do.
The world's better place for having Kimi Raikkonen in this case.
Maybe that's a feature. I co-drive for Kimi or something. Maybe not.
Right, we were going to hold you to that. We want to see that on the BBC television before the end of this year. Yep.
Don't choose the Rally Australia, though, because he couldn't be bothered flying there.
That's right, he couldn't. No, that's true.
Okay. Sports car racing, I wanted to mention as well, because it's potentially fantastically exciting with Porsche coming in and Audi being beaten by Toyota. I mean, unthinkable only a couple of years ago. So, and I'm mentioning this because, as you rightly point out, there's so much else going on apart from Formula One. It's very easy to get obsessed with Formula One, isn't it? Do you take any interest in these? You know, are you so busy?
Yeah, I think I've got quite a lot of friends in motorsport and different motorsports around the world, so I always take an interest at least to find out how their weekends have gone, just out of courtesy, if nothing else. I did go to Brands Hatch to a GT race last year, and I was, by my own admission, slightly clueless about the whole thing, but that's the whole thing. I mean, I've never pretended to know everything about motorsport, and the fact that you can go into these things, you know, you can have a great day, you can always learn something. It doesn't matter who you are, what you are, you can always learn something. So I tend to take a interest in various motorsports because, as I say, I have a lot of friends doing sports cars or Indy cars or whatever, rallying and everything, so I've got to be able to hold a decent conversation.
You know anybody in NASCAR?
No, I don't know anyone in NASCAR.
No, I was when you were saying Indy cars, I was just interested to.
If your sprint cups and things, you've got PK, and I know him, and I keep in touch with him, but I actually have never been to a NASCAR race. So.
You should.
My goodness
me, that's another thing you've got to do before the end of the year.
Everybody should leave.
Absolutely.
I did do the NASCAR swap with Tony Stewart and Lewis actually at Watkins Glen 2 years ago. That was great fun. And just even the difference in the drivers and the crowd. It was such a foggy day. So it was sort of Watkins Glen, cold, foggy day, and we'd just come off that freezing, wet 7-hour endurance race of the Canadian Grand Prix that Jensen eventually won. And just as we all got onto the grid, and Tony Stewart was so excited, and as he steps into Lewis's Formula One car, a huge moment in his life, some guy shouts out of the grandstand, "Tuck it in, Tony," as he's trying to squeeze his way into this into this F1 car. And I thought, oh my God, this is great. I like it.
Well, it was funny on Sunday after all the carry on in Malaysia. Sunday evening, I watched the NASCAR race on TV, which ended with a fight. In fact, it ended with a huge accident on the last lap, a result of a grudge match between Joey Logano and Denny Hamlin, which sadly has put Hamlin in hospital for quite some time. So Logano maybe doesn't find it quite as funny as he appeared to at the time. But after the race finished, the camera invariably at a NASCAR race focuses in on, right, where is today's fight, post-race fight. And this was Tony Stewart attempting to separate Logano's head from the rest of him. But after the, there was, then there were ads and this, that and the other. And they went back, and Stewart is walking towards the camera with some pace, with an interviewer sort of running alongside him, sort of like trying to get him to speak. And did you see any of it? Well, it obviously had been filmed sort of at least a few seconds earlier, because virtually every word was bleeped. And I thought, yeah, this is a bit more animated than...
Puts the bottom lips and Sepang into perspective, I guess.
Yeah, it did. I mean, Sepang seemed all very sort of genteel. And
well, actually, you know what? The end of Sepang might have been better had it been an out brawl between Webber and Vettel.
That's exactly what Gary Anderson told me he was hoping for. He was reminiscing about the days of, you know, James Hunt and people getting put off and then expecting to see your car come round, and then he wasn't there and all this. Yeah. And Gary on the way back was like, do you know what? Today was fantastic. All it needed was a good fight.
Yeah, I agree. I'm with him.
I remember saying to Prost once about, this is after he'd retired, just about reminiscing about the troubles with Senna. And I said, you know, you think back now, would you do it differently now? And he said, yes, I would have hit him. I should have hit him. I still think now I should have hit him.
I don't think Webber was too far away from it, was he? I think he wouldn't have taken
I don't think Webber versus Vettel would last very long.
Jones and Reutemann, yeah. You know. And the suggestion that after, you know, the similar happening in Rio in 81, they should bury the hatchet. And Jones said, yeah, mate, right in your bloody back.
But, you know, sport is about heroes and villains. It's about the public identifying with characters, either loving them or hating them, isn't it? I mean, sport's got to be dramatic and exciting. It really has. And that includes motor racing. And the Americans for sure as hell provide it, don't they?
It frustrates the hell out of me sometimes that guys who, you know, from talking to them privately, that they've got fantastic personality, character, they're warm, you stick them in front of a microphone in Formula One and all of that just switches off sometimes. And that is very frustrating, because a lot of people think that they're all bland and faceless, and they're not.
No.
I mean, away from them, they must frustrate you as well, Lee, particularly, because, you know, you've got to deal with it. But, you know, when they're unguarded and you see what they're really like, there are some fantastic personalities there.
Just on this Webber-Vettel thing, I mean, on a serious point, these sort of feuds, inter-team feuds, can get out of control. We've seen it in the past, and, you know, how damaging they can be. I mean, you know, the biggest example forever will be Villeneuve and Pironi. How do we think the guys themselves and the team will handle this situation from here on in?
Let's ask Lee McKenzie, because she's there all the time.
Well, firstly, I thought it was interesting, actually, on Sunday, the difference in team radio, and we don't get to hear all the team radio, and I expect there's more to come out. Well, I know there's more to come out. But how Ross Brawn communicated with Nico.
Absolutely.
And Lewis, yeah. The difference of Ross's very distinct, you will not do this, Nico, It was like, you know, being at school, you're about to let down your friends, your family, the team, you know, everything. It was a definite thing. Whereas I didn't really hear that from either Rocky or from Christian. So you could get away with saying, I didn't really hear, I didn't understand the message, I chose to ignore the message, however you interpret that. But the difference, there was no way you were going to go against Ross when you heard that.
No, it was just sort of quiet authority.
Absolutely.
Bring the cars home, please.
Yeah. You will not do this, Nico. Do that. And actually, when I interviewed Nico afterwards, you know, I had a huge amount of respect for him, because not only is he going round the pen doing the same disheartened interview in six languages, it's incredible. But he had an understanding, he had a respect, there was a respect for Ross. Whether it's right or wrong is not the point, but that system absolutely worked. And then, by contrast, you've got Christian now trying to cover his own back, protect his team, still try and protect Sebastian and Mark at the same time within reason, and it seemed like a mess. And this is, you know, the so much money, endless advertising, all this, you know, cool new team. In actual fact, all you needed was, yeah, maybe the hard line, I don't know. But as Christian said, Sebastian would have ignored him anyway. That's not the point.
I have a lot of sympathy for Christian, because I think his authority is inevitably compromised by Helmut Marko.
Absolutely. I 100%
agree. The culture of that team is the way it is because of Helmut Marko.
Yeah, I agree.
But
yeah.
Briefly, though, guys, it is true to say that obviously I didn't hear all the radio either, but I never heard Red Bull explicitly give a strict, meaningful order. I heard a lot of stuff about this is getting silly.
Well, that's my first question to Sebastian was, did you get an order from the team? Because, you know, sometimes you can miss the most basic fact. And the most basic fact is, if he'd suddenly turned around and said, I didn't get it, then the foundations of the rest of your interview have been destroyed. So when he's confirmed to me that he did get the order, then it's open season. Then you can absolutely go for him. Why did you choose to ignore it? Well, but what he should have done, if he'd said, instead of the sort of, I still don't really understand to a certain extent what he was saying, but if he'd said, listen, I'm a racer, red mist came down, I needed to get past, to win a world championship, you need maximum points. If he'd said all this, you would have gone, okay, that's a strong argument. Absolutely. You know, that's fair enough. Whether you agree with it or not, you can understand that that argument, but there wasn't really any clarity from the pit wall or from Sebastian in the end, and it was just a mess.
No, and initially he said, I didn't do it deliberately.
Yes.
Yes, he didn't deliberately lunge down the inside into turn one and keep it going all the way to turn four.
Imagine what would happen if he had done it deliberately, you know?
I always remember this when we drive into someone at a roundabout.
I think the thing, looking back on the Jones-Reutemann thing, I mean, that never, ever, ever repaired itself. And at the end of the year, Reutemann was in the running for the World Championship with Piquet, and it was all settled in Vegas. And I remember the whole of that weekend, all through practice, qualifying, everything else. Jones was on pole. Carlos was on pole, excuse me. Carlos was on pole. But of course, the question to Jones was, who do you want to be world champion? And of course, it was, couldn't care less, mate.
Yes.
Neither one of those. Can't do with either of them.
I think Jonesy was a man to say, oh, I'm terribly
sorry.
But my
point is that there was absolutely no question of even daring to ask Jones if he would help Reutemann.
Sure. Okay, well, it's been highly entertaining, has it not? And I very much hope you out there think so too. Lee, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely fantastic. Fresh from Sepang, and we'll see her again in 2.5 weeks in China. What a life! Let me just remind you quickly, everybody, of our subscription offer. I did talk about it at the beginning of the programme, but to remind you, you can save up to £29 and receive a free Simon Taylor Lunch With book. And that's obviously a book of Simon Taylor's lunches with motor racing people, which I think it's true to say, Damien, is one of the most popular features in the magazine.
It is very popular.
So if you do subscribe, which we'd love you to do for obvious reasons, save money and get Simon's book. Totally free of charge. Good. Thank you for joining us, everybody. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.